Good afternoon, everyone. So before I forget, let's think about our schedule a little bit. I think we won't meet the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so that's not next Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. We'll take that week off, and then we'll resume after Thanksgiving. So the title of the talk is Unentangled Knowing. And the phrase unentangled knowing comes from a teacher named Upasaka Ki Nanian. Upasaka Ki was a Thai teacher of the last century. And what makes her remarkable, what makes her stand out, is her name Upasaka means laywoman supporter. She was not an ordained nun, and so for her to be teaching and not be ordained was singular. But for her to be teaching and for her to be a she, not a he, in Thailand was also remarkable. Now, because Thailand is a deeply patriarchal culture, it's from Upasaka Ki that I get this phrase, unentangled knowing. It comes from her book called Pure and Simple, which is just that. It's a marvel of purity and simplicity of expression. And she has this little poem. An inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going, outward knowing, cast aside. This captures the essence of her experience, an inward staying, this inward turning, unentangled knowing. Consciousness that's not entangled in contents, not entangled in objects. All outward going, looking for something out there that will do it for me. All outward knowing. Cast aside, dropped off. She has, in the background of these verses, an encounter that the Buddha has with a celestial being. I think I may have mentioned before that the Buddha has these conversations not only with human beings like ourselves, but with formless beings. And in this particular conversation, this celestial being addresses the Buddha by his family name, which is Gautama. His name is Siddhartha Gautama. So the celestial being says, the inner tangle and outer tangle, this generation is entangled in a tangle. So I ask of Gautama this question, who succeeds in disentangling this tangle? Who succeeds? How do we untangle the tangle? So what's the tangle? And I invite you to look at your own experience. What's the tangle in your own life? What, if anything, are you tangled up with? So classically, traditionally, the tangle has to do with craving. We crave things, and when we get them, we cling onto them, and we get tangled in them. It has to do with aversion, with trying to push away objects, contents in our experience. And so it's like flypaper, you know. You touch it, and you get stuck on it. Tangling has to do with seeking. Seeking something out there. It has to do with resisting. And the Buddha had five metaphors, five images when he talked about this tangle. And the images are debt and illness and prison and slavery and wandering in a desolate country. And he said that getting unentangled or becoming awakened, uncovering the freedom, the nirvana that is always already here. He said, it's like being freed from debt. You know, like you've just been encumbered by this debt that you have been lugging around. And finally, you're free of it. Or you've had this illness, perhaps this acute illness. It's really just knocked you flat. Or this chronic illness that you've just been bearing up under all this time. And it's like you're cured and you're finally feeling well again. Or it's like you've been enslaved. Somebody, something else owns you. They own you body and soul. You don't belong to yourself anymore. You're enchained. Or he says, it's like being in prison. This could be a literal prison, like the scandal of mass incarceration that is going on in our country. It might be imprisoned in a mood. Imprisoned in a cultural construct. And then his final image is as though you're wandering through a desolate country. And there are no inns of refreshment. There is no oasis. And it's just an endless trudge. And he says, finding your way to a pleasant inn, a really nice bed and breakfast. You know, where you're not struggling through a dry and arid landscape. That's what nirvana, awakening, enlightenment, salvation, self-realization, whatever you want to call it, because it's beyond naming. That's what it feels like. These different forms of liberation. Some of us have been coming together at my home on Sunday afternoon before our sitting to do a book study, and we've been studying Guy Armstrong's book, Emptiness, A Meditator's Practical Guide. Guy was one of my teachers. This is one of my teachers at Spirit Rock, and I love his teaching because of the clarity of his thought. And here's something that Guy writes. He says, when we operate from craving, which is where we're operating from most of the time, when we operate from craving, everything that touches us gets graded on the scale from pleasure to pain. We desire the contacts that give the highest pleasure scores and fear those with the highest pain scores. Delusion, or as it's sometimes called, ignorance, one of the three poisons, craving, aversion, ignorance. Ignorance gives neutral experience a score of zero, so we just ignore it. You notice grading in your life? grading yourself, grading others. That's the operation of craving. And the Buddha said, that's the essence of suffering. One of the questions when you sit in this chair, in the teaching chair, is where does the teacher find teaching? And I have found myself drawn to two sources of teaching right now. And I want to commend them both to you because I think they're really the foundation for our contemplative practice. One is some kind of movement practice. It might be... It might be yoga, it might be Tai Chi, it might be Qigong, it might be something else for you. But my Qigong teacher, Peggy Watson, is really opening some things up for me, and I'm very grateful to her for that. I've been a Qigong practitioner for a long time, some 20 years, but I haven't had a teacher in a long time, and it was great to discover Peggy is a teacher. And then, as you've heard me say, I've been recently to Spirit Rock and been with my teacher, Philip Moffat. One of his students, a woman named Dana DePalma, who's also a teacher at Spirit Rock, has been doing a small group that gathers together by Zoom. I haven't done much gathering by Zoom, but I'm just so pleased with being able to master this technologically. Dana said something this last week when we were together that she used a phrase that I hadn't heard before, and her phrase was habit mind. Habit mind. Habit mind is just conditioning. It's just the ordinary operating system, to use Cynthia Bourgeau's term. It's the habit mind that we're walking around with all the time. And it's what we conventionally think of as ourselves. Rupert Spira, the teacher that I mentioned last week and from whom I want to draw tonight, Rupert Spira says that this habit mind is composed of thoughts, feelings, memories, and perceptions. This is what we think of as ourselves. And when we examine it closely, all these things have an end, do they not? Your thoughts, my thoughts, they arise and they come to an end. And you know, and then there's another one. And we might have a recurrence of a particular thought again and again and again, but even this recurrence, there are gaps in the recurrence. So thoughts come to an end, and so do feelings. And even feelings that generalize themselves into moods. Even moods can resolve, can dissolve. But we know that feelings do too. They arise, and they stop. Think about, I know some of you, I know some of your stories, think about a time when it was really hard for you. And how perhaps that really hard time, whether suddenly or gradually, is not hard anymore. Or it's not hard like that. Or I think for myself of a really sweet time, the 20 years that Kathy and I were together. And with her dying, that came to an end. So, happy thoughts, happy feelings, sad thoughts, sad feelings, these come to an end. Memories we tend to think of as relatively stable, but even these change. And somebody asked me something by email this afternoon about a novel that we'd read, And I know I read the book, but I sure can't remember the particular passage that she was asking me about. So, you know, memories come to an end. And boy, they come to an end more frequently for me these days. So thoughts come to an end, feelings come to an end, memories come to an end, and so do perceptions. You know, perceptions is just arising like bubbles, you know? Like, it's just cooler in here tonight than it's been for some time. There's a difference in perception. The body is our perceptual instrument, and our bodies are changing too. Just look in the mirror. So we mistake, this is Rupert Spira's insight, we mistake ourselves for this cluster of thoughts and feelings and memories and perceptions. These come to an end. There is something that does not come to an end. It has never come to an end in your whole life. And that is the knowing of these thoughts. The thoughts come and go, right? But the knowing is just here. Feelings come and go, but your knowing of the feelings, oh, I know I'm delighted. Oh, I know I'm a little scared. That knowing is always here. Perceptions come and go, memories come and go. But this that does not go away is knowing itself. I remember I've said this to the book group that meets in my home. I remember the very moment when I was on a month-long retreat at the Forest Refuge in Western Massachusetts. And I was several weeks into the retreat, and I was just asking myself this question. What knows this sound? There was just a sound in the meditation hall. Somebody came into the hall. There was a sound. And the inquiry question was, what knows this sound? And this may not seem particularly revelatory to you, but to me it was. In the quietness and in the concentratedness of my mind, oh, knowing knows this sound. Knowing will know the next sound. You cannot not know your experience right now. You cannot not know the temperature of your hands. You cannot not know what you're thinking about. You cannot not know the commentary in your mind right now. It's undying. It doesn't die. And the Buddha says it was never born either. It's always been here. Because we're in it. We're swimming in this sea of knowing, consciousness, awareness. So I want to read to you, this is a rather long passage, but this is from the book I mentioned last week, this Being Aware of Being Aware by Rupert Spira. And it's the very beginning of the book. Everybody loves happiness above all else. Even if we deny ourselves happiness for the sake of another person or an impersonal cause, we do so ultimately because it makes us happy. In order to fulfill the desire for happiness, most people engage in a relentless search in the realm of objects, substances, activities, states of mind, and relationships. The search also takes the form of resistance to whomever or whatever is perceived to jeopardize our happiness. Thus, seeking and resistance are the two main impulses that govern the thoughts and feelings and the subsequent activities and relationships of most people. So I'm going to give some commentary as I read on this. So check this out for yourself and see when in your experience, in your day, in your evening, you are neither seeking nor resisting. And see if, when it's a neither nor, where happiness is. Just the invitation is to check that out as an experiment for yourself this week. Just notice, oh, I'm seeking this. And I'm seeking, I just want the light to change. Or I'm resisting this. The activities of seeking and resisting are an inevitable expression of the sense of lack or suffering that underlies them. However, most of us never question the origin of our suffering. And that, by the way, is what the Buddha did. He said, where does suffering come from? He questioned the origin of his suffering. So busy are we escaping the discomfort of it through the acquisition of objects, substances, activities, states of mind, and relationships. If we do question it, we usually attribute it to the absence of the object or experience that we seek, or the presence of the situation we're attempting to avoid, and as a result, never fully trace it back to its original cause. We think the cause is out there. Our belief that happiness is dependent on objective experience is not altogether without foundation. And hence its almost universal allure, for every time a desired object is acquired or an unpleasant situation successfully avoided, happiness is indeed briefly experienced. You know, when you get the thing that you want, you know, I've been looking at that car, I've been thinking about buying that car, and you finally get that car, you know the reason that you're happy now? Is because you're no longer seeking. You finally have it. And a week or a month or a year after you've gotten the car, how's it going for you? This is the way the treadmill of desire works. So things do, people do make us happy for a time. And then, because of the truth of impermanence, they don't. Back to Rupert. However, through the acquisition or avoidance of the object or situation, although the acquisition or avoidance puts a temporary end to the suffering that underlies it, and as a result brings about a brief moment of happiness, it does not uproot it or bring it to a permanent end. It simply masks it. That's the consumer society. It's a big masking. It's an endless masking. Back to Rupert. No sooner does the object, substance, activity, state of mind, or relationship diminish or disappear, or the situation we sought to avoid disappear, reappear, then the happiness vanishes and the underlying suffering returns. You know, I've spoken to you quite frankly about this. This is really what happened to me. And very soon after Kathy left my life physically, the underlying suffering just roared back into awareness. As a result, most people set out again in pursuit or rejection of some form of objective experience in the hopes of repeating the experience of happiness. In this way, we become addicted to the endless cycle of lack, seeking, temporary fulfillment that characterizes most people's lives, and to which Henry David Thoreau referred when he said that most people lead, you can fill in the blank, lives of quiet desperation. Many people spend their lives managing this despair more or less successfully, medicating it with substance, numbing it through acquisition of objects, avoiding it through exotic or meditative states of mind, or simply distracting themselves from it with activities and relationships. However, at some point, either spontaneously or in the most cases as a result of reading a book or having a conversation with a friend, some people begin to question whether or not objective experience can ever really be the source of the lasting peace and lasting happiness for which they long. Others reach a point of desperation or hopelessness before this intuition dawns. I'm going to skip a little bit. This process is described in the story of the prodigal son, in which the son leaves the security and comfort of his father's kingdom, explores all the possibilities that the world or objective experience has to offer in terms of pleasure and satisfaction, and eventually realizes the futility of his search. Finally, he turns around toward the source of happiness symbolized here by his father, which was in fact always available to him, but seemingly out of reach due to his exclusive fascination with the drama of experience. I love that phrase, fascination with the drama of experience. In this giving up or turning around, we cease being obsessed with our suffering and become interested in the nature of the one who suffers. We turn away from the objects of experience and investigate the nature of the one who suffers. In this investigation, as the mind turns the light of its knowing, so we're back to knowing again, turns the light of its knowing from the objects of experience towards its own essence, toward its own knowing, it is gradually, or occasionally, suddenly, divested of its limitations and stands revealed as the very peace and happiness which it previously sought in objective experience. This is a different kind of consciousness. That's what he's talking about. A different kind of consciousness that comes from this turning and looking not at the objects of what we want out there, but at the essence of mind itself. Peace and happiness are not as such objective experiences that the mind has from time to time. You know, you say, oh, it's a good day. Or say, oh, this is not such a good day. They are the very nature of the mind itself. Happiness is our essential nature, apparently obscured or eclipsed much of the time by the clamor of objective experience, but never completely extinguished by it. It is for this reason that all the great religious and spiritual traditions indicate, in one way or another, that the ultimate goal of life, lasting peace and happiness, resides within us and is equally available to all people at all times and this is bracing, in all circumstances. So the Buddha says, and Rupert Spira is echoing, we get entangled with objects and awareness, thoughts, memories, feelings, perceptions. And our practice is about how we disentangle. And now I want to come back to movement practice, Qigong, because one of the ways that we are so entangled with experience is because we are living up here in the thought factory. And we hope that if we could just penetrate it and see it more clearly, if I could work hard enough that I will somehow be able to sort it all out and to disentangle the tangle. And what Qigong has to teach, and what my teacher Philip Moffin and Dana De Palma are teaching me right now, is that this shift in consciousness happens not through effort, but through relaxation. I'm pausing to let that sink in. So then the question becomes, well, how do we relax? You know, if you're kind of having a bad day and somebody says, you know, you just need to relax, don't you want to hit them? I heard a story recently about someone who was at a neighborhood gathering, and the conversation dangerously turned to politics. And one of the neighbors found himself throwing a chair down on the ground. He became exercised by the conversation. And someone in the group told him that he just needed to calm down. Can you imagine the effect on this man? It did not go well after that. So I want to give you a real-time, in-the-moment experience of what I mean by relaxing down. And Heather and I go to a Qigong class with Peggy Watson, and I want to show you this beginning stance and teach you a Chinese word. The word is sung. And it means relax and drop. Relax and drop. The way we began the meditation tonight, of just feeling the support of your pew, your cushion, your seat. That's an invitation to relax and drop. So we're going to do something different. I want to invite you to stand with me. We're not going to do anything exotic. I'm not going to ask you to move your arms. If you can stand, you can do this. Looks like everybody can stand tonight. Okay, so bring your feet about shoulder width apart. And I actually want you to make the outsides of your feet parallel. So in order to make the outsides of your feet parallel, you have to be a little bit pigeon-toed. It's subtle, but it's a little bit pigeon-toed. Right. And let your knees be unlocked. So not back like this, but just unlocked. Good. And let your eyes be up this way. And let yourself stand in your feet. Not on your feet, but in your feet. If it helps you to close your eyes to do this, please do so. And let yourself, let the weight of your body sink into your feet. And one of Peggy's instructions to us is, let your feet spread out like pancake batter poured into a skillet. Let your feet spread. And let your attention rest inside your feet as you stand in your legs and not on your legs. Standing in your legs, in your feet. And now invite your body to relax. Relax and sink. So that anything that you're carrying, any heavy or even light baggage, you just let it sink. You let it drop. And as you keep your attention in your feet, be aware of your breathing. And relax a little more. And sink. And relaxing. And sinking. Good. So if your eyes are closed, let them gently come open. And if you like, you can shake your hands. Just kind of shake it off. Good. And you can sit. Thank you. So we don't have a microphone. If I had thought about this beforehand, I'd get Doug to pass a microphone. But I want us to talk just a little bit about what did you notice as we did that? What were you aware of? What was knowing your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, your memories? There was a knowing that was going on. What came into the space of knowing as you did that? And there's not a thing you are supposed to know. It's just what you did know. What did you know? If you can speak as loudly as you can, just so people can hear you. What did you know?
Presence.
You knew presence. Presence, yeah. Mm-hmm. Candy, say that one more time.
I brought off all energies of an extremely stressful day.
Thank you. So Candy said that she dropped off all the energies of an extremely stressful day. Yeah. Good. Thank you. You knew the weight of your body. This is called the earth element. The weight of our body is called the earth element. Or it's called the meat body. You know, like the body is a piece of meat. It's called the meat body. And you knew it. You knew the weight of your body. Yeah. That's different from knowing what your weight is on the scale, isn't it? It's a very different kind of experience. Was there any judgment about the weight of your body? No. Yeah. Thank you. The power of memory. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I just think it's such a wonderful mechanism to keep our love and delight. A lot of people know how to live with us.
Yeah. Yeah. So through memory, our loved ones they're alive in there. We know them, don't we? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Jerry, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, just the awareness that you can actually relax that deeply standing. I don't know about everybody else, but that's like a unique experience for me. I'm so used to relaxing either when I'm sitting or when I'm down. But the awareness
Yeah, yeah. So Jerry's saying to discover that he could relax in the standing position and not just in the sitting or lying down position, that was a fresh discovery. I was in the checkout line at the grocery store yesterday, the 10-item checkout line, and so there was a woman who had about 25 items, and she was laying them out there, you know, on the thing, and I want to tell you, I was not relaxed in my standing posture. You know, I was craving. In fact, the cashier said, you know, sorry, but there's a 10 limit, you know, 10-piece limit here. And she was, you know, she was embarrassed. She was ashamed. And she loaded her stuff back into her cart. But it did not occur to me, and this was a missed opportunity for mindfulness. It did not occur to me to relax. Okay. Yeah. Good. Anybody else?
I noticed that when you said panicking, that I wasn't completely aware of the tension in my until I took them to another level of relaxation.
Yeah.
And it sort of relaxed a little bit more and brought my awareness there a little bit more when you said that.
So the comment was the image of the pancake batter spreading brought a different kind of attention and awareness to the feet. Our teacher Peggy also has another image. She says, you know, the reason that elephants can bear this enormous weight that they're carrying around is that when their feet touch ground, they actually spread. Their feet spread. So it's another image like the pancake batter. Yeah, who knew that a deeper kind of relaxation could happen in the feet with an image. It's just an image, right? You know? I wasn't manipulating your feet with my hands, but imagery has a great effect on the body. Yeah. Anybody else? Jean, yeah. I'm so glad you said that, Jean. Jean said that the instruction to stand in her feet, in her legs, was really helpful. And I had forgotten that instruction until Judy Blinn, who is usually here tonight, was at our Sunday sitting, and she reminded me that this was a standard instruction that Kathy used to give in her Qigong class. So it was really sweet to hear that again, to stand in our bodies. Yeah, yeah. So one question I'm curious about, and then I'll wrap this up. As we were doing that, what was going on in the thought factory? Yeah.
The desire to lose the self in the meditative state, so to kind of drop in, but drop in really fast all the way, and just lose.
Yeah, so here's this natural desire for freedom, for awakening, this loss of this grasping self. And of course, what we do is we grasp to lose the grasping self. So there's this, you know, this just onward going merry-go-round of grasping. Yeah, yeah. That's the way the mind works. Yes. Yeah. So look at what happens in the world of knowing. You know, it's like, well, this feels a little weird to be standing, you know, pigeon-toed like this. And guess what? It's kind of dinner time. You know, I'm getting hungry. Again, did you have a choice about whether to think that thought? Absolutely not. But it's knowing that's the real refuge. I think I want to say just one thing in closing. If you've been coming here for the last year, some of you have, some are newer, I have been talking about this stepping back from objects in awareness, thoughts, feelings, whatever, and being aware of awareness itself, being aware of knowing, this knowing capacity of the mind. The Tibetans call it the cognizing capacity of the mind. And that invitation to be aware of objects in awareness and awareness itself is a concession to the way the mind works. But closer to our experience is, and I'll use the image of a laptop. All right? So you got your laptop open and, you know, you might be watching a movie on it, you might be reading email, you know, working your spreadsheet, whatever it might be. There is the screen of the laptop, and it's being modulated by the content that's on the laptop, right? The screen is primary. These modulations come and go, but the screen is there, right? the screen is being influenced, affected, colored, we might say, by experience. And that's the way it's going in our minds too. Thoughts, feelings, moods, memories, perceptions, all these are coloring knowing. But the knowing itself is colorless. It's like this book, right? What we notice if I open up this book is print, right? What we tend not to notice is the white page. That's in the background. When we're looking at our computers, right, we don't tend to notice the screen. We notice what's on the screen. The invitation here, and we'll unpack this more, is to make this turn into the knowing capacity of the mind, because that's where real freedom and happiness are to be found. It's not out there in what's on the computer. The movie will come and go. You like the movie, you didn't like the movie. That will come and go. But what doesn't come and go, and when we can make contact with this, this is the place of liberation and freedom and healing, is the knowing capacity of the mind. More to come on that. So that's it for a moment. So one of the ways that we unentangle the mind is loving kindness. Because the nature of knowing, the nature of the awakened mind is love and compassion and joy and equanimity. And so we can get a foretaste of this awakening when we do loving kindness practice. So let's begin with ourselves and with one another, sharing this space, this energetic field together tonight. And we send these wishes to one another, to ourselves and to each other. May you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in love. May you dwell in peace. And taking this wish right into the center of your heart, let this wish be planted for yourself and sending it out to the center of everyone's heart around you. May you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in the kingdom, the realm of love. May you dwell in the great spaciousness of peace. And we send these wishes out into this neighborhood, around this church, to the Belmont area, larger Nashville community, in ever-widening circles of inclusion, to strangers, loved ones, difficult people, all beings, visible beings, invisible beings. May all beings be free from fear, free from obsession. May all beings dwell in the great spaciousness of peace and love. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of joy and peace and happiness, and to the ending of suffering. So I will be away this weekend, so the meditation group that meets at my home normally on Sundays, I will not meet this week. We'll meet the following week and the week after Thanksgiving. Rami Shapiro and I will be teaching together at St. Mary's Suwanee the first weekend in December, December 1st through 3rd. Our retreat is on birthing the Christ within. It's birthing this knowing. The knowing's already there. It's awakening to the fact that it's already born. If you're thinking about coming to this retreat, if you could go to the St. Mary's website and make your reservation by the end of this weekend, that would really help us get a sense of how many people are going to be coming. I'd love to have every one of you. I think it's going to be a great retreat. So have a lovely evening, lovely week, and I will see you next Wednesday. Thank you.